you know, still allow him to exercise this immense pressure on the people that he's trying to control without ever stepping over the line of violating human rights. So that makes him a very different kind of dictator.
Professor, last year, Fox News host Tucker Carlson took a show to Hungary. I had said it was Sean Hannity, but it was Carlson, where yes. Tucker Carlson repeatedly praised Orban's immigration policies. This is what he said.
That is exactly why Democrats become hysterical when you mention the obvious successes that are on display here in Hungary on the immigration question. They don't want you to know that there is an option to the chaos and filth and crime growing all around us. We don't have to live like that anymore. Actually, we could have a functioning country.
So if you can comment on this and the whole white nationalist trend in the United States, some of the people actually modeling themselves on Orban as Orban followers.
Yeah, in fact, it's exactly on immigration that you see the sharpest parallels, you know, between Orban and Trump. So, you know, if you know the what Trump did to stop immigration, he first built a wall. Well, Viktor Orban first built a fence. Then Trump pushes the people who are seeking asylum back across the border to wait in this kind of limbo before they can get into the country. Orban set up these things he called transit zones, which again were a kind of limbo as people awaited, you know, entry. The similarities between Trump and Orban are so extreme that there was even a point about 6 months before the U.S. started doing it when Orban started separating parents and children. Now, they didn't lose track of which parents were connected to what kids, as happened here, but they decided that they had no human rights obligation to feed the parents in these transit camps, but they did have an international obligation to feed the children.
We have 10 seconds, Professor.
They took the children, fed them, and then brought them back to their parents so the kids couldn't share food. So all of that was stuff Trump copied.
Well, Professor Kim Lane Shepley, Professor of Sociology and International Affairs at Princeton University, specializing in the rise and fall of constitutional government, focusing on Hungary. That does it for our show. We'll do part two with Professor Shepley and post online at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Messiah Rhodes. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Thanks for listening to KVOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is BKM.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, a Black August special. George Jackson was born in Chicago, Illinois. He was one of five children. He was arrested in Northern California in 1961 when he was just 19 years old for allegedly attempting to rob a gas station at gunpoint for how much? For $600. He was sentenced to 1 year to life in prison, and he spent the next 11 years in prison. Most of those years were in solitary confinement. While in prison, George became a revolutionary, an organizer, and an author. He, along with fellow prisoner W.L. Nolan, founded the Third World Coalition and founded the San Quentin Prison Chapter of the Black Panther Party. He was becoming well known in radical circles in the United States and internationally. And for this, he was dubbed a troublemaker for his revolutionary views and activities by prison authorities. In 1970, W.L. Noland, after it was revealed that he planned to file a lawsuit against the superintendent of the prison where he was held, he was killed by a prison guard. George Jackson and two other prisoners, Fleeta Drumgo and John Couchette, were later accused of killing a prison guard in retaliation for Noland's murder. They became known as the Soledad Brothers and were a cause celeb in the Black and other militant radical movements. They gained the support of Angela Davis, who visited George Jackson and maintained a friendship with him while he was in prison. A month after his brother Jonathan Jackson and two other prisoners were killed attempting to free prisoners, George Jackson was killed in 1971 by prison guards. In response to George's murder, the New York State-based Attica prison uprising took place just weeks after George Jackson was killed. 1,500 prisoners released a manifesto with their demands, and they controlled the prison for 4 days. The then Governor Rockefeller of New York ordered that the prison be stormed by law enforcement, and 29 prisoners were killed. None of those prisoners were armed with guns. Today, George Jackson is remembered as a revolutionary who fought for his freedom and the freedom of others. His two books include Blood in My Eye and Soledad Brother, The Prison Letters of George Jackson. To this day, we're told that any prisoner in California found with even the name George Jackson found anywhere on his person or in his cell would be disciplined. Let us hear what Walida Ismarsha, a longtime educator and writer who teaches at Portland State University, had to say about the legacy of George Jackson. Let's go to that clip now.
George Jackson's legacy can't be overstated. His example has been foundational and transformational for organizing happening behind prison walls for over 50 years at this point. His deep commitment to real, thoughtful political education, his pairing theoretical foundation with principled action and engagement, his collectivity, both in learning, in leadership development, in liberation struggle. I encountered George Jackson's work in high school while learning about and studying the Black Panther Party. As I deepened my own engagement and support in organizing with folks who are incarcerated, I realized how foundational George Jackson is and began studying his work more deeply. I have learned more from people who are incarcerated than I have in formal education settings, and George Jackson is definitely among my teachers. His legacy continues to this day. I have seen his work cited by folks organizing on Texas's death row, during California's prison hunger strikes, in youth facilities in Oregon, in restricted housing units in Pennsylvania. And while the state murdered George Jackson in an attempt to silence him, what they really did was make him unstoppable. Beginning with the Attica uprisings, partially started in response to his assassination, George Jackson has been inextricably part of movements to change the world. And those movements have changed the world. Not just policies and procedures, not just lives and laws, they have changed the DNA of our struggle. George Jackson is part of the DNA of our struggle, and the principled lessons and examples he set still resonate today, both inside and outside the walls. Through his writing, his work, his study, his commitment, his sacrifice, he has become part of the foundation of creating the new just world we want. He has shown us the power of organizing. He has shown us that the reason we are so repressed is because we are so very powerful. He has shown us anything is possible if we are strong enough and bold enough and brave enough to create it into existence. George Jackson's life is a historic certainty that has guaranteed the liberated futures we want.
Today, we focus on George Jackson, and from the Freedom Archives 99 Books series, we will hear reflections on George Jackson from Angela Davis, James Baldwin, Sundiata Tate, and Rachel Herzig. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Several states held primary elections Tuesday. Kansas voters overwhelmingly rejected a measure that would have allowed the Republican-controlled legislature to tighten abortion restrictions or ban the procedure outright. It was the first time voters had a chance to weigh in since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in June. Voters rejected a change in the Kansas Constitution to ensure that it does not grant a right to an abortion, overturning a 2019 Kansas Supreme Court decision protecting abortion rights. In Michigan, Trump-backed conservative commentator Tudor Dixon won her primary. She'll face incumbent Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer in November in that state's gubernatorial race. In Arizona's Senate primary, Republican Blake Masters won his primary and will face Democrat Mark Kelly this autumn. Masters is a venture capitalist and has endorsed Trump's election fraud lie. Trump-backed conspiracy theorist and election denier Mark Finchem has won the GOP nomination for Arizona's Secretary of State. Finchem is now the sixth election denier across the country to win the Republican nomination for the job that controls election administration in the states. They've all backed efforts to restrict voting rights. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has left Taiwan after a visit that angered Chinese officials. Beijing has responded with live-fire military exercises in the waters surrounding Taiwan, some of which have entirely encircled the self-governing island. Feature Story News's Patrick Falk reports.
Shortly after Nancy Pelosi arrived in Taiwan, the military announced long-range live-firing drills in waters to the east of Taiwan. It also announced exercises that would be taking place on Thursday, which would essentially encircle Taiwan in six different locations. But analysts have said that any hostile act seems unlikely, although its response is likely to exceed anything that we've seen in recent years. Importantly, any act of escalation is likely to take place after Nancy Pelosi leaves on Thursday to avoid any confrontation. But certainly President Xi Jinping needs to be seen to be strong on this issue and at least to China's domestic audience.
And that's Patrick Falk reporting. Congress is considering a package this week that could make major new investments in climate change mitigation and major investments in health care affordability. Public News Service's Mark Richardson reports.
One study finds from 1970 to 2020, the average American's health care cost rose from $1,875 a year to more than $12,500. Jim Manley with Consumers for Quality Care says the main concern is that out-of-pocket costs are too high, according to a group's new poll. He says Arizonans agree they're getting squeezed by health care costs.
High deductibles, rising out-of-pocket costs, and unpaid medical bills are plaguing American healthcare consumer.
I'm Mark Richardson.
The first grain ship to leave Ukraine since the start of the war with Russia has passed inspection in Istanbul and is heading on to Lebanon. Ukraine says 17 other vessels at its ports are loaded with grain as well and waiting permission to leave, but there was no word yet on when they could depart. Authorities said a joint civilian inspection team spent 3 hours today checking the cargo and crew aboard the cargo ship Razoni. A deal last month involving Ukraine, Russia, Turkey, and the UN aimed to ease world food shortages by creating a safe corridor across the Black Sea. World food prices have been soaring, and the war has blocked exports from Ukraine, a major global grain supplier. California Attorney General Rob Bonta announced Tuesday that tens of thousands of Californian consumers are eligible for restitution following a settlement announced Tuesday in Oakland between the California Department of Justice and Rent-A-Center, a rent-to-own furniture and electronics store. Bonta said the settlement amounts to $15.5 million, and more than $13 million of that will go to consumers who entered into certain lease agreements with Rent-A-Center. Here's Bonta.
Rent-A-Center might claim to offer, as they say in their materials, quote, worry-free guarantee, end quote. But our investigation into their conduct found the opposite to be true. Rent-A-Center caused lots of worries and provided too few guarantees.
According to the complaint, the state investigation centered on Rent-A-Center's kiosk business, which operates in retail stores like Ashley Furniture. Prosecutors allege that the cash price Rent-A-Center charged Rent-A-Center customers was 15% higher than the retail price. And legendary Los Angeles Dodgers broadcaster Vin Scully has died. He was 94. Scully called Brooklyn and L.A. Dodger games for 67 years before retiring in 2016. Scully's distinctive style and delivery provided many memorable moments over his long career, like this call of a Hall of Fame Dodger pitcher Sandy Koufax's perfect game at Dodger Stadium in 1965.
It is 9:46 p.m. 2-2 to Harvey Keene, one strike away. Sandy into his windup. Here's the pitch. Swung on and missed, a perfect game.
The Dodgers said Scully died at his home in the Hidden Hills section of Los Angeles. I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and today, a Black August special. We commemorate the life and contributions of George Jackson. Now, 2022 marks the 21st anniversary of the killing of George Jackson, educator, theorist, writer, revolutionary, and prisoner. George Jackson's personal and political development, his sharp, his capacity to organize, and his deep humanity have been an inspiration for people who want to make change, those who consider themselves revolutionaries around the world. The legacy and impact of George Jackson resonates today throughout movements across the United States and indeed around the world. In addition to yearly commemorations of his practice and ideas, the symbol of George Jackson is present wherever there is struggle for self-determination and justice. And as I said in the intro, we are told that in California, any prisoner that is found with any memorabilia or even the words George Jackson written anywhere on his person or in his cell are punished. And in fact, some of them could even go into solitary confinement. That is how much of a threat prison authorities still consider George Jackson to be. Now, we want to thank the Freedom Archives for their 99 books series. Why 99 books? 99 books were found in the cell, in George Jackson's cell after he was killed. Now, what you're going to hear were primarily recorded in the summer of 2021. They are reflections, remembrances, and statements on George Jackson's legacy, impact, and relevance for today's movements from those who knew him, as well as organizers, educators, and artists inspired by his life. We have made a selection of those. I want to remind you that the clip we're going to play from James Baldwin was recorded in 1971. It was one I had never, ever heard before. But first, let us start with hearing reflections on George Jackson from Angela Davis. Let's go to those clips now.
I encountered George Jackson for the first time in connection with the organizing efforts around the case of the Soledad brothers in Los Angeles. I was teaching at UCLA. I had been fired from my position and had a court injunction that allowed me to continue to teach. At the same time, I was having to fight for my right to teach. I met George in person when I traveled to Salinas with a group of people from the campus at UCLA to attend one of the hearings that was happening. By that time, we had done a lot of organizing on the campus, and we brought people from Southern California to participate in the hearing. And that was the very first time I saw him. And I didn't really have the opportunity to have a long conversation with him, because you know what conditions are like when you have prisoners who are shackled and chained inside of a courtroom. But I did get to know his family well and embarked upon a correspondence with him. So my relationship with George was largely through the letters we exchanged around a whole range of issues. I was totally impressed because here was someone who had been in prison for almost 10 years. He was extremely learned. You know, I remember thinking at some point, maybe George should be teaching the course that, you know, I'm supposed to be teaching on Marxism here at the university. But it was the first time that I came to be aware of the prison as a site for learning and knowledge production. And I think the impact that George had on other people behind bars was to encourage them to learn how to live the life of the mind to a certain extent, to emphasize intellectual work as a way to retain some modicum of freedom behind bars. Very soon I realized that he wasn't simply an individual. He wasn't simply an extraordinary individual, which he was. But at the same time, he encouraged community and collective efforts and political education. It was really an eye-opening experience because I had been doing work around political prisoners for quite some time. But this was the first time I began to get a sense of life under those conditions, and not only the oppressiveness of prison life, but the ways in which George and others were using that time to learn and develop themselves. And I suppose what was most impressive to me, and this has remained with me to this date, is the extent to which he was totally aware of what was happening in the so-called free world. And had ideas that were profound, and to this day, I always reflect on the fact that if we could use all of the intellectual energy of people who have spent all of this time teaching themselves and learning, that we could perhaps really begin to address these huge problems in our society. We would figure out, you know, how to begin to move in a more radical, more progressive direction. In response to the question about the impact George had on my own capacity to think more deeply about the institution of the prison, you know, what I should say first is that my focus had been on political prisoners. I had been involved in many campaigns to free political prisoners, whether it was Huey Newton, whether it was Lolita Lebron, whether it was Los Siete de la Raza. This was my connection with the prison. And that actually had a long history because when I was much younger, I was a part of a community that involved people who ended up going to prison during the McCarthy era. My parents were friends with people who were sought by the FBI because of their membership in the Communist Party. So I always tended to think about that institution as the place where political radicals were, those who were who constituted explicit dangers to the state. I didn't think about the larger functioning of the prison as an apparatus of racism and repression until I began to have this correspondence with George, and it struck me that we can't simply talk about people who are in prison for their political beliefs and activities, but we have to begin to analyze the institution as a whole, and that was a really powerful insight. And when one has been affected so long by the prevailing ideology, and you don't question the fact that this person is a criminal, so obviously that person belongs in prison. It when one realizes that these constructions are all ideological, it opens up so many new vistas, and it allowed me to think not only as George had formulated about the way in which the institution itself functioned as an apparatus of racism, and therefore simply focusing on political prisoners did not address the larger function of the institution. And I also recognized that as long as I was living in the so-called free world, I tended to think about prisons, jails and prisons as affecting men primarily. And so as a result of my thinking about the institution in ways that George introduced to me, I began to think about the specific role of the institution in relation to women. Because what I experienced was something I had never ever imagined, because all of the literature I had read, all of the conversations had been around men. So I can say that my engagement with George had a profound and transformative effect on my thinking. So many lessons. George was an intellectual. Even today, we sometimes underestimate the role of the intellectual, or the intellectual is considered to be marginal to the actual struggle. And George demonstrated that in order to begin to develop a sense of the nature of the struggle we're involved in, we have to think, we have to read, we have to reflect, and we have to engage in collective reflections. Now that that I've read so much more than I had read then, I know how important education, political education, has been in inside prisons everywhere, from Antonio Gramsci and his amazing prison notebooks, to Nelson Mandela, Lolita Lebron. So I think that that one of his lasting legacies is has to do with the purpose of knowledge, the role of knowledge. And he, I think, exemplified how knowledge can be used in a radical and transformative way, how it can be used to change the world. Of course, Frederick Douglass emphasized that without education, there is no liberation. But I think that message gets lost sometimes, particularly given the terrible state of the educational system, which is responsible in part for so many people ending up in prison in the first place. George had a way of following these trajectories and thinking about these circuitous connections. And I think that he really led the way toward a field of study that is now actually a part of a number of university campuses, critical prison studies, that is interdisciplinary, that is interdisciplinary in the broadest possible way, interdisciplinary not only in involving all of the disciplines, but in recognizing that knowledge gets produced in many different places, and especially behind bars, into seeing the prison as a site for the production of knowledge. So when I look at the amazing studies that have been produced over the last, I would say, 10 to 15 years, I can trace that development directly to George's insistence on study and collective learning. Thank you for giving me the list of the books that were found in George's cell. And I really appreciated looking through the list, because almost every single text has a memory attached to it. And I was not surprised. But there was one really major surprise, and that was the presence of June Jordan's, an early collection of her her poetry. June is someone who became a very close friend of mine, and I, I love her work and the ways in which she used her talents as a poet to bring change into the world. June was the was I don't know, maybe one of the first major public figures to speak out in solidarity with Palestine. I just want to say that when I saw June's book of poetry alongside Marx and Engels and Herb Aptheker and Maurice Cornforth and all of those, it really brought a smile to my face, because I think that we understand better now the role that art and poetry and music play in helping to produce the kind of radical movement that does hold possibilities for change. George was really an internationalist. And as I think back to that period 50 years ago, I realized that that there was a greater capacity to feel as if we were living in the world, not just in one country, but that the world was the place where we lived, and the world was generator of our responsibilities. And I know that George read very widely. He was aware of what was going on in Vietnam, and he read Ho Chi Minh, and he read about the struggles in Latin America that were unfolding at the time. He was very fluid about what was happening in Africa. And it was very clear that that his stage was an international stage, even though during the last period of his time he was locked up in a small place in the San Francisco Bay. But he was living in the world. He was inhabiting the world. And I think that that kind of internationalism is really needed at this moment, considering the impact of neoliberalism and global capitalism and American exceptionalism, that even in this really spectacular moment of awareness about structural racism, there's the tendency to assume that it's only valid here in this country, and therefore not to think about the ways in which racism has become so institutionalized. Colonialism, slavery, the very basis of capitalism. So that our struggles here should be placed within a context that includes what's happening in Brazil, that includes struggles against police violence in South Africa, because the institution in South Africa is still a racist institution, even though the majority of police officers are Black. That's one of the most compelling examples of the structural and institutional character of racism. So I think that we would do well to study the ways in which George and others develop this sense of themselves as a part of the planet, not simply a part of the United States of America. And to see that someone cultivates this from a prison cell is even more inspiring.
All righty, and that was Angela Davis' reflections on George Jackson, recorded in the summer of 2021. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. It is Black August, which emerged from the August 21st coalitions, which were organized in the late 1970s to honor George Jackson, a political prisoner who was assassinated in August 21st, and also other political prisoners who are still inside and who were killed. That according to Charisse Burton Steele. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we will hear from James Baldwin, a little known clip on George Jackson that was recorded back in 1971. Stay with us, we'll be right back. That is the song 99 Books by Matt Callahan and Yvonne Moore, a tribute to George Jackson. Our focus today, this being our Black August show, you are listening to Sojourner Truth. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. There's a lot of voices to hear, so I want to go straight now to a clip from James Baldwin that was recorded back in 1971, a very rare clip of Baldwin, of course, who was an essayist, playwright, novelist, and voice of Black struggle. James Baldwin never ceased to reflect on his experience as a Black man in white America and is regarded as one of the most mid-20th century writers. Let us go now to hear from James Baldwin. James Baldwin, his birthday was actually August the 2nd. Let us go hear now from Baldwin.
It's difficult to talk about this because there are two things. I'm haunted by the face of his mother because it might be my mother. and I had brothers and sisters, and I've been haunted by the face of Jonathan because it could have been my brother. I'm trying to say that beneath the political implications of this bloody event, there's also an anguish which has endured in my country for nearly 400 years. I think this anguish has some implications for all the countries of the West. And I think that one has the right then to suppose that the burden of proof is on the American authorities and not on the people who contest this particular story. I myself have lived through too many murders and too many assassinations to believe a word that Nixon or Reagan or John Mitchell or any of the other American authorities say. I do not believe that a boy can hide a gun in his hair. I do not believe that a maximum security prisoner can receive a visitor who is neither questioned nor identified. I challenge California to identify Madam Anderson, who carried something in her shoe, I think. I think that we, if we really are going to be serious about this and to prevent another murder in another prison or in another American street or on a French street, had to assume that we have nothing to prove. I have nothing to prove. I know very well what it is like to be a black man in America. I know very well that the intention of the American Republic, which after all comes out of Europe, was to keep black people slaves forever. And I know that now that black people have discovered in their own minds, in their own hearts, that they are not what they are told they were, that America's on the verge of panic, on the verge of civil war. I scarcely know how to be in any way objective this afternoon. For me, there's been Medgar Evers, who was murdered in Mississippi, and Malcolm X, who was murdered in New York, and Martin, who was murdered in Memphis, and Huey in jail, and Bobby in jail. And one begins to wonder how long one can keep paying that bill. And what I want to suggest this afternoon is that instead of paying it, endlessly going to funerals, endlessly seeing widows, endlessly seeing corpses, endlessly being told lies, that we challenge them. I want Ronald Reagan to write a letter to me and to George Jackson, telling me exactly what happened in that prison and how he knows. I want Nixon to confirm it, and the Attorney General of the United States and his charming wife to tell me why we are still in prison and at their mercy. As long as that is so, the entire Western world is doomed.
Entire Western world doomed. Okay, that was James Baldwin back in 1971, and thus the references to Reagan and Nixon. And the reference to the gun hidden in his hair was authorities claimed that George Jackson had a gun hidden in his afro, if you would believe that. Anyway, that is exactly what Baldwin, part of what Baldwin is questioning here. But let us quickly now move on. By the way, if I'd like to refer you to the Freedom Archives website, the 99 books found in George Jackson's cell. You could find the entire list of those 99 books on the Freedom Archives website, and also the full reflection on George Jackson. And we want to thank Claude Marx from Freedom Archives. But let us go on now to hear a clip from Sandiata Tate, who was one of the San Quentin Six. look up San Quentin Six to learn about him. I'm not going to take time to explain that to you now. And he continues to be active in prison abolition work. Let's hear the words of Sundiata Tate on George Jackson.
In Percy, DBI, in 1962, he had come to the segregation unit from San Quentin, him and Jimmy Carr. George, the way he communicated, he always talked about that matter, you know. And when he'd be having discussions, he would be educating because he had a deeper understanding of how society worked. And he tried to enlighten others so that we were all growth. He's very honest, in my opinion, and dedicated to his beliefs. They would talk about socialism, talking about us ruling ourselves instead of being ruled by others. And that was one of the things that just the way he communicated with people. You know, I remember when he was getting ready in November before Thanksgiving, he organized everybody in the segregation unit to across racial lines, you know, to throw their food out on the tier. You're throwing your Thanksgiving dinner out on the tier. We did it, you know. I don't want to forget this. George had a very profound impact on those who would end up in the adjustment centers, in the B section, the segregation unit, in the hole, because he was being there a lot. So he was able to pull and influence comrades. He pulled a lot of people into being more conscious. He wanted to be a rebel. He really wanted to be what George advocated. He'd be a revolutionary. But we're young, we don't really know how to be a revolutionary, right? We just, you know, listen to this brother. And one of the things he knew is that you have to stand up. In particular, you have to stand up against racism. You know, we didn't necessarily understand the class thing necessarily, you know, but we definitely understood racism. And George tried to get us all to understand. And by the way he organized the LeFou strike, he sought to bring others into trying to make a change inside. He encouraged us to read. That is one of the things that he pushed. Because he could organize people. He could organize prisoners. I mean, who in that atmosphere, Tracy, who brings people together across racial lines at that particular time? I think it was because, you know, he had a lot of integrity and everybody knew he would put his life on the line for his beliefs. He would stand up against injustice, not just for you, but somebody over there too, you know? And I remember being on the yard at Quentin, and sometimes people sitting around and having a conversation. and people would listen to George. He would talk with insight and you'd be able to understand him. For me, the fact that he was always studying, and if he wasn't studying, if he was conversating, he was conversating about something, not about a bunch of BS. You know, a lot of times we inside, we talk a lot of BS, you know. We don't have a small environment, you know, so a lot of stuff, you know, is pretty common. And George wasn't the only person, you know, that was developed, you know. But to me, what made him special, he was able to rate to the people that would get down, people that maybe would not tolerate a lot, you know. He was able to organize those of us like that, you know. And I will always, in my heart, have the deepest respect and love for George Lester Jackson, because he was a brother that committed his life to making a change, to getting us off our knees and up on our feet as a people. I think it's a different time and a different era. But for those who are dedicated, I would say one of the best things they can do is study. And not only study, but dare to challenge the status quo. To dare to change the status quo. George was so committed that he was willing to give his own life through that struggle.
Wow, George Jackson, and that was Sandietta Tate, one of the San Quentin Six, where he says, get up off your knees. That was what George meant to him. Get up off your knees and stand up. Dare to challenge the status quo. Dare to change the status quo. Today, we are focusing on this Black August show on George Jackson, who was killed just actually 51 years ago, but his legacy is still being felt. He was killed by prison guards. We are now going to go on to hear from Rachel Herzig, her reflections on George Jackson. She is a community advisor for the Center for Political Education and has been an organizer and community educator in movements against policing and imprisonment and interpersonal as well as state violence. We'll play as much of Rachel's as we can before we have to wrap up today's special. Let's hear from Rachel Herzig now.
I know for a fact that I had to be taught about him. And I know for sure that no one in my childhood would have done that. And I also feel pretty confident that no one responsible for the bulk of my formal education would have taught me about him either. And that's important to me because I also don't remember not knowing about him. So at some point, somebody taught me about who he was, about his politics and why he was important. And now, you know, I'd like to thank that person. My best guess is that it was probably sometime during my years in college, but I don't have a good sharp memory of when I first encountered George Jackson. I think the primary impression that I had of him was kind of just awe, you know, that this person was writing with such kind of just unflinching directness about the not only his own condition, but the condition of Black people in the United States and to some extent globally. And that he had such a clear way of talking. He's one of those writers that just kind of like, as you're reading him, fills you with your own fire. So I think my impression of him was, you know, just awe. that he was just like a badass and totally charismatic, even, you know, coming across the page like that. But the other thing that happened is that as I started teaching people, George Jackson's writing became a really important teaching tool. So one of the things that I did was I taught in a program for people coming home from jails and prisons in the state of New York. So I can't tell you how many times I taught Soledad Brother and Blood in My Eye in that program. It was the number one pick of most of my students who, you know, had good facility with reading. So we would go to the library and the organization and they could pick whatever they wanted to read. And, you know, those books just kind of flew off the shelf continually. So his work became a very important teaching tool for me. And as I taught his work, I began to see him, you know, kind of more and more as an educator too. And so I think his role as a political educator, I think the kind of fact of how he shared his analysis and the audience for his work is really, really crucial. And I think that the clarity with which he described his own kind of political and intellectual evolution is also really crucial, because it gave people a really great model of self-education and a really great model of political development. And, you know, it's often said about him that he, you know, he entered prison as a social prisoner but became a political prisoner because of the actions that he took and the kind of role that he played in inspiring other people inside prison walls. And I don't think that can be underestimated. I think that is a big part of his legacy. He's known, his writing is known as memoir, right? Or, you know, there are these letters and then there's the description of his own situation. And I would have to say that's probably thing one that appealed to students that I taught in this program about his work. And it was one of those things where, you know, it was kind of word of mouth. So somebody would be like, I read this thing and this guy was amazing and you should read it too, right? So it wasn't that, you know, mysteriously his book kept flying off the shelf. It was that people knew that this guy was talking about something that they understood, something that related to their own experience, and that they would be able to see themselves reflected in his work in some way. And his ability to articulate his own experience, I think, it was really, really key to what was attractive about his work for the students that I taught. But I also think his ability to do that transcended and was, for lack of better language, somewhat universalizing, right? So Black people could see, even if they weren't in prison, even if they were not experiencing what George Jackson was experiencing, they could see themselves reflected in his articulations of the condition of Black people in the United States or his anti-imperialist positions. And I think that that clarity of articulation of kind of what his own situation was, but in a fairly universalizing way, is also part of what makes his work super powerful. You know, as a really obvious thing, thinking about the Attica uprising, and thinking about, you know, the hunger strike that prisoners went on directly connected to his death, I think is, you know, one of those things that in the U.S. prisoners' rights movement is very well known and very respected, and it just speaks to kind of the impact that he was able to have.
All righty. I think that cue means we have to wrap up. I was hoping to hear a bit more from Rachel Herzig, but looking at the clock, I could see we are running very short of time. I really want to thank our Freedom Archives, and I would hope that you will go to their website where you can see the full list of the 99 books that were found in George Jackson's cell after he was killed by prison guards. This has been our Black August special. And George Jackson, you know, arrested when he was 19 years old, lived out the rest of his life in prison. He was arrested at 19 for allegedly attempting to rob a gas station of $600. He became an organizer within prison, and as Sandieta said, really gave his life fighting for the freedom of prisoners and bringing out the conditions of Black people in the United States. But as Angela Davis pointed out earlier in this show, he was an internationalist. So go to Freedom Archives website, the 99 Books project, and you will be able to hear a lot more about this. So Black August, of course, August is the month to remember political prisoners and all prisoners, but in particular, political prisoners who are still being held in prison and those who were killed in prison. Now, Mumia Abu-Jamal, one of the longest standing political prisoners, he called Black August, quote, a month of injustice and divine justice, of repression and righteous rebellion, of individual and collective efforts to free the slave and break the chains that bind us. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our assistant producer, Alicia Vargas. I'd like to thank our board engineer, Gary Baca, to welcome our board engineer in training, Z. Orozco. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Go online to Pacifica Radio Archives.org. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!, Sojourner Truth. We'll be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening, and you all please stay well and safe. George Jackson, 99 books.